And during some of the toughest times, I have a little piece of paper in my wallet that I keep all the time, even to this moment, of different things that mean to me, different sayings that mean a lot to me, things that I strive for, recognizing my responsibility to give back.
Reoccurring mantra I got into in college where I would just say, I'm going to break the mold.
2 days after my second injury, my dad flew out to Indiana and we drove home, went right up to my room, slept for a day, and then I woke up the next morning, I spray painted my wall, no quitting me. I remember, you know, there is no quitting me and I won't give up.
The number one thing you gotta remember is you're transferring energy. And whatever energy you got is the energy the viewers are gonna have.
You are listening to Intentional Performers with Brian Levinson, where we talk with experts of craft about their journey and what they have intentionally done to be their best self. As we talk with them, the hope is that we uncover intentional gems that you can use in your life. Now, let's kick it over to Brian to introduce this week's guest.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Intentional Performers Podcast. I'm Brian Levinson. Excited to have you with us for another great episode today. But before we get to today's guest, I just want to let you know how you can help us out at the podcast. First of all, thank you for being here. Thanks to those of you that have shared these conversations on social media or with a friend or via email or text or however it is you can help us expand our reach. Thank you. The other way you can continue to help us out at the podcast is by going over to patreon.com/intentionalperformers. And over there, you can subscribe to the show for as little as $2 a month and as much as $10 a month. Thank you to everybody who has already done so and everybody who continues to listen to these meaningful conversations. I am extremely, extremely grateful. Now to today's guest. Today's guest is David Cuthbert. I got introduced to David by a mutual friend named Tim Ogden. David and Tim both went to the Naval Academy where they played soccer. David was the captain of the Naval soccer team, and he's going to talk about that experience and how that helped shape his leadership and his career, really, and how there was a watershed moment while he was at Navy that helped really dictate the rest of his life in a lot of ways. So we're going to get into his experience as a soccer player, but David at his core is a leader. He is somebody who took that word captain and really turned it into something that he relished and appreciated. And he is somebody who is obsessed and is always learning about leadership. So this conversation is mostly about that and what it takes to lead people and humans and the human element of leadership and the challenges that come with leadership. So David is a CEO of a nonprofit called Wine to Water, and they do incredible work. So they work all over the world. They've worked with over 700,000 people in 30 countries to provide them with water. And when I say provide them with water, I don't mean that they give them bottles of water or come in and just, you know, provide them water. They actually dig wells and create sustainable resources so that those communities can have water and continue to access that crucial element that sometimes we take for granted in the United States. And honestly, there are places in the United States now that don't even take it for granted. And that's something that we'll discuss in this conversation. But David and Wine to Water go into these communities and help. And they don't help them with a Band-Aid. They help them with a long, sustainable resource so they can have clean water. And there are places all over the world that don't have that simple, what should be a human right. We have enough water in this world that everybody should have access to clean water. And David and Wine to Water have been on a mission to do just that. So David is doing incredible, inspiring work. And I encourage all of you to learn more about what Wine to Water does. And we'll talk about it in this conversation as well and get involved if you feel inspired to do so. So as a CEO, he oversees the global operations of the organization, making sure that water is being provided to those who need it most around the world. David also worked in special ops. And when I say worked in special ops, I'm going to leave it at that because he's going to give you a little insight into what he did in special ops and what his career was like when he was in our armed forces and what it was like to be in the front lines in really, really hostile environments. So David has been an elite soccer player. He's worked in special ops in really rugged environments. And then he went to the private sector and worked in for a startup and working as a CEO of a tech company. So he has done a bunch of different things. David is a maximizer. He's always trying to figure out how to make an impact in this world. So he's worked in the nonprofit sector and in the corporate sector. He's worked for our military and he's been an elite athlete. So he checks a lot of boxes for the type of intentional performers that we're looking for. And more than what David has done is who he is and how he operates in the world. And David leverages a lot of different skills and techniques to try to be his best self. And that is why I really appreciate David. He has an even keelness about him, but also an emotional intelligence and a warmth about him that I hope will come across in this conversation. So at his core, David is a leader. He loves serving people. He has found it to be exciting, fulfilling, and meaningful to stick his neck out and try to help others live better lives. And David is always sort of asking himself the difficult questions as far as how he wants to live his life and the perspective and the way in which he wants to see the world and how he's interpreting the world will come across in this conversation. So I know you're going to love this conversation with David. So without further ado, I'm so excited to present to you, David Cuthbert. David, thank you for coming on the podcast. We are in Arlington, Virginia. And really excited to have this chat. We've had some conversations over the phone and we were just chatting before we fired up the mics. So I'm excited to chat with you and to learn from you. And hopefully our listeners will as well. Where I'd love to start is just to get some background information on what your upbringing was like, what childhood was like. Let's start there. And then we are going to get to what you're doing now, which is fascinating and amazing and inspiring with water. And excited to get there. But start young with me and just give me some idea of what life was like for young David.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. It is awesome to be here. And I thank Tim as well. He's been a good friend for a long time. So I'm glad to make the connection, man. And it's been fun to listen to your podcasts over the last several months and so forth. So it's cool to participate in one. So thanks. Yeah, I grew up in, outside of Philly for the most part. Most of my family is from Philadelphia. So, this is a big year for us, you know, being Super Bowl champs.
We're gonna stop the podcast right now. So for those that don't know, I grew up outside Washington, DC and was at the Washington Redskins game yesterday.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. And they lost, but
well, so did we. So.
But if I might say, the Eagles, I think, lost by a way wider margin. for those that don't follow football, Philadelphia, Washington, their football conference, no one really likes each other very much. And, but there is a massive place in my, I'm not going to say my heart, it's somewhere else in my body for despising Philadelphia fans. It is a, it's a massive, massive space. And until a Philadelphia team hires me to work with people, that will maintain. But once they hire me, that will probably go out the window.
Then you're all in. Yeah.
I'll be good.
Yeah.
But for now, we're going to just keep our distance during this conversation.
Right on.
But you grew up outside Philly.
Yeah, I did.
So, what part?
Well, in South Jersey, primarily in and around the city most of our lives, but grew up in Gloucester County right outside of, right across the Delaware River there. And pretty typical childhood. I mean, and I mentioned Philly in a way because it's such a team sport oriented town. And that's the way I grew up. I grew up in team sports my whole life. Played all, baseball, basketball, soccer was my primary sport. And that kind of carried me through college. Went to high school in Wilmington, Delaware. Went to a Catholic school down there and enjoyed that experience. And then, went on to Navy after that. But I grew up with a brother and sister. I'm the middle child and, pretty close with those guys still today. We're all very close in age. So, grew up with a lot of kids in the neighborhood playing a lot of street ball, a lot of yard football, a lot of things like that. And, yeah, pretty typical for the most part.
What's the age range between the three of you?
So my brother is 2 years older and my sister is actually one day less than a year younger. So we're born within the same year. And grew up in the same grade, actually. So a lot of people thought we were twins growing up, but we were actually not. I was the oldest kid in the class, and she was the youngest.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty rare.
It was pretty rare, is right.
And are you – so did you guys have similar friends or kind of do your own thing, or what was that like?
Yeah, so my sister and I, for sure, we were very close in the same grade, all the same circle of friends. And, we were as much friends as brother and sister in a way. my brother, you know, he kind of kept his distance, I think, for the most part. We were the younger two and did his own thing and, you know, grew up kind of just looking up to him in a way. And I'd say we were close through grade school, high school, but it really switched when he went to college. I think we became very close at that point in time and have remained very, very close ever since. You know, he was sort of in high school doing his own thing and so forth. And I just sort of wanted to keep up with that in a way. And, but when he stepped out of that and we had a bit of distance between us with him going to college, it was pretty awesome. We spent as much time together as we could, and we still do that even today.
And Wilmington's not that close. How far was Wilmington from your house and going to school there?
Yeah, that's a pretty tight area, as you probably know, but 25 minutes, so yeah. Not too much of a commute. We were probably 15, 20 minutes into Philly and about the same distance into Wilmington, so we lived right between those two cities growing up, yeah.
And going to Catholic school, was faith a part of your upbringing, and how did Catholicism play a role or not?
Yeah, it was. I mean, and faith still is a part of my life. Not so much in the Catholic realm anymore, but grew up Catholic. I guess it was part of the decision to go to Salesianum, that high school. But if looking back, I would say it was much more about the education, experience, the discipline my parents were sort of presenting to us. It wasn't actually mandatory for my brother and myself. We decided to go there, had the option to leave according to sort of my parents. If we wanted to go back to the public school system we came from, my sister stayed there. She loved it, thrived there. But we just found a really cool niche there. And I think sports had a lot to do with that. You know, you put 1,200 teenagers in a place and it's a pretty competitive environment, very sports driven. So it was a good place for us to play soccer and other sports along the way.
And talk about your parents. What were some of the values that they passed down to you?
Yeah. They're big time, just as far as shaping us, they were just great parents. I'm unbelievably grateful for both of them. My father has since passed away. My mother still lives up in Philadelphia. But just hugely formidable in passing down values. I think of a family. My mom was really sort of adamant, and we had great I grew up with four grandparents, so, you know, which is kind of rare to some extent. But, you know, everybody was very focused on family, just being together, sharing time together, welcoming guests, being hospitable to people as they came into our home, into our life. Very, very charitable, I think, in a lot of ways. And I guess the one thing I would say about my father, just steady, man. Just like, you know, just keep doing the right thing. Keep working hard. Just keep on the path wherever you want to go. Just, you know, just keep plugging away. There's no shortcuts to success. You just have to continue to work toward it and put the time in every single day, you know. And I think that steadfastness that he was able to sort of just demonstrate for us in life, I think was big.
When did Dad pass?
2011. Okay. Yeah. So not too long ago. So, you know, we, pretty fortunate in the fact that we got to spend a lot of time together over the years, some more than others, depending on travel and so forth. But, yeah, big influence in my life for sure.
Yeah, you lit up when you were talking about just like steadfastness, yeah. A little smile and like a sense of pride that at least I could see in you right now. So I'm curious, what do you feel when you have the opportunity to talk about your dad?
Man, gratitude. That's the biggest word I think that would probably come to mind right now is gratitude. So super thankful for the time I got to spend with him. So grateful for just what he did pass down to me. And it's funny, you know, for people who have sort of lost parents like that, it's interesting because the things that they taught you become more alive because I think like they're the things you actually hold on to. So if he's still here, I may not hear some of that messaging as clearly as I do today because he's here and I can talk to him and we have interaction. It's like, yeah, you know, I'll talk to you tomorrow, what have you. But now you cling to what you've heard. Mm-hmm. And so that stuff like literally comes to the surface all the time. And I think that like that's what you hold on to. So those messages and those lessons are that much more powerful because that's what you have. And that's how you remember somebody, is to sort of continue to live that part of the story out. And so when I think about this, you know, it's an incredible gratitude because he had given me so much to go from and to use in my own life. And I don't know if I fully realized how much that was until he actually passed away. Certainly I would want him back in the room, but man, am I grateful for what I'm able to kind of carry forward in a big way.
It's an amazing perspective. And I always tell, especially young people, that if you live long enough, like, people are going to pass that you really care about. And do you want to live long? And they usually say yes. And I go, then, you know, part of living is also going to be dealing with that sort of stuff. And I think that what you just said is so, so powerful. And I'm thinking about that in my life where my dad's still alive. Like, you know, how can I really take his words as if he might not be there tomorrow? Because the reality is he might not be.
Right.
I think that's just an interesting way. And then I'm thinking a little bit about the power of historical figures, which is what we sort of talked about it before we started recording. And you can have mentors that are not alive. And maybe those words that they have spoken in some ways are more powerful, to your point, because they're, that's the word. Those are the words.
That's what you have.
That's what you got.
Yeah. You don't have all the sort of just the regular stuff, you know, like what's going on, how's the weather, all the stuff that all gets stripped out. Like, you don't hear any of that stuff anymore. You hear like the, just those key messages. That's what you remember. And major events, of course, but you know, this, it's the really important stuff that just shaped you in ways that you probably didn't realize in the moment that show up later. And you probably experienced this, but I experience this now all the time. I do things and I'm like, man, that's my dad. Like, that's, I feel like I'm turning into him every day, all the more. Right. And so that's the stuff I think you, you hang on to, and the things that you, you really realize have shaped you in a lot of ways.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Let's go back to soccer.
Yeah.
So, high school, I'm assuming you start to be pretty good at soccer. What position did you play? And talk about soccer. And did you stay with baseball, basketball, or did you start focusing on soccer once you got to high school?
Yeah, great question. So I was a kid, when I was a kid, I played soccer pretty much all year. Fall sport, spring sport. Played basketball in the wintertime. Played baseball in the spring. Loved baseball. I was, that was, I think, my first love for a game was baseball. Played it all the time in the yard and so forth. Played soccer because I was on a team. But I played baseball all the time. Thought that was most definitely going to be the sport I sort of just stuck to. When I went to high school, there was good baseball players there. And I realized I probably wasn't as good as I thought I was going to be. And did not make the freshman team. I just couldn't hit the curveball or something. I'm not sure what was coming at me.
Was that one of your first failures that you can remember?
I think so. Like, first one that mattered, because that was the sport. And I actually had told my, I remember telling my mom, if I don't make this baseball team, I'm probably going to go back to the other school. Like, I don't think I'm going to stick around here. But by spring of my freshman year, I don't make the team. That actually was funny. It just became a little less important than the community that I had in the school. And I had played pretty well in freshman soccer there, but, you know, pretty typical in high school there. I was a freshman soccer player on a freshman soccer team. So nothing outrageous. Played center midfield. So I was in the middle of sort of the action. Went on sophomore year, played JV soccer on the JV soccer team. I think it was between the sophomore year and the junior year in high school where the switch sort of went off. I felt like I'm actually getting a lot better at this sport, and there might be something there to actually pursue. And I think that's when I really started not just playing soccer, when I really started loving soccer, when I felt like I'm improving at this, and this is fun to see myself get better against some of these other guys that I
Can
played.
Do you remember what you loved about it back then?
I loved the team. I mean, I really did. I mean, I had great guys on that team, people that are still some of the closest people in my life today. But I love the physical nature of it. Like just the dynamic element of playing soccer on a field. I loved it. And I still do to this day. I watch it. I love the mechanics, the chemistry, the way that the flow of the game happens, the way the teams play off one another. It's so when I watch soccer today, if I'm watching a goal, the goal is great. I love the build up to the goal. I love the passing, like all from the goalie to the goal. I love that part of the game. So that's what I sort of watch for when I watch the game today. And I just loved being a part of that, right in the middle of it, and was able to kind of help control that to the greatest extent possible. And then I think the element of self-improvement in that process, that was the most material thing I could see in myself that was actually changing very quickly and improving very quickly. And I just kind of latched onto that too. That was exciting.
So you still play center mid as you move up to varsity, junior and
yes.
senior
year? Yeah.
And so that's when you really blossom though. You start taking off and mm-hmm. playing well. Mm-hmm. When does college soccer come into your mind?
Yeah, I think that junior year. So my brother mentioned him before. He played soccer and he was 2 years ahead of me. So when I was a junior, he was a freshman in college and he went on to play college soccer as well. Back then it was Philadelphia Textile. Now it's something different today. But, when I saw that, again, it's, you know, I kind of looked up to him in a lot of ways. I thought I could do that. I mean, I don't know at what level at this point, but I want to do that.
Were mom and dad athletic?
My dad was very athletic. I think he would consider himself like an all-star playground guy, mm-hmm. you know? So he grew up, they both grew up in Philadelphia. So playground sports were big for them. Organized sports, were not, and nor was college. That neither one of them had went to college. My dad went in the Navy after high school. You know, they didn't grow up in sort of that environment that we had grown up in, that they were helping us kind of grow in.
What did mom and dad do for a living?
So my mom was a real estate agent in New Jersey and did that for 30 plus years. My dad worked for Philadelphia Electric Company for most of his career in different areas of that in that business. So we were pretty well anchored in Philadelphia and in and around that area through their careers. Yeah.
And so you start playing well and talk about playing college soccer.
Yeah. So, I mean, to this day, it's like one of the experiences I still draw from, maybe more than most others, like just practical experience of leadership, of lessons learned, of all that. So, you know, I played at Navy and I have to imagine playing at Navy is a little bit different than playing in other places, especially for the coach that I played for.
Well, it is, regardless of coach, because I've worked with athletes that play at Navy.
Yeah, so yeah, you know.
And I work with athletes that play at other schools.
Right.
I haven't worked with athletes at Army, so I can't speak to that. You could probably speak to that a little better than I could, but
I'll hold off.
Yeah, we'll do a rival podcast and we'll get into all those good things, but so before we do that, you're looking at colleges, why Navy? Like what's the draw to Navy?
So, it's really kind of an interesting story. I'm fourth generation Navy in my family. So great grandfather, father, now myself, but all of that stuff happened before I was born.
And none of them went to the Naval Academy.
No, they did not.
So explain to people the difference, because some people might be ignorant to what the Naval Academy is and what being in the Navy is.
Yeah, so joining the Navy is an option, right? So you can get out of high school, be 18 years old, and join the military, any of the branches of service, and join in various fields and be a soldier, sailor, airman of some kind within the military services. The Naval Academy is a 4-year college, and it's like other colleges, but it's not like other colleges at the same time, meaning we have majors and curriculum and so forth. varsity sports, D1 athletics, and all that that comes along with other universities. The difference is you graduate and you become an officer in the armed forces, and West Point and Air Force Academies being the same. And you're commissioned as an officer in these services with a commitment toward service. For me, when I graduated, it was 5 years post-graduation that I would be a naval officer, and choosing that path would happen when I was a senior. And then, you know, you kind of go into that field and you have to pay back those 5 years for the 4 years of your college education. And then you can continue on if you'd like to do that.
So just to clarify for the civilians that are listening, so you go to Navy, it's free.
Correct? Yes, it is. Yeah. It's a government school. Right. Yeah. It's the Navy's.
But what I think David didn't hit on also is getting into Navy is no joke, and it's very competitive and very difficult and very challenging. And there are all kinds of things you have to do, to get in.
Yeah.
And academically rigorous, and you know, 4 years if you were just a student at Navy is challenging from an academic and a commitment standpoint.
Yeah.
And then you add on another layer, which is being a Division I athlete. So where else were you looking besides Navy, or were you pretty set on going there?
Yeah, great question. I was not set on going there. So going back to sort of me being fourth generation, Navy wasn't actually on my radar at all when I was a junior. I really wasn't thinking about college too much when I was a junior, but it was actually my high school guidance counselor came to me and said, hey, have you ever considered applying to one of the academies? And I said, no, but if it was, it would only be Navy, because I had, you know, these are the stories I've heard. I didn't have any other stories to go from. So I said, I just would never go back to like my grandfather and say, hey, I'm applying to West Point. Like, it just would not have happened in my life. So he said, it wasn't driven by myself or my parents at all. And, so I went home and I remember telling my dad, I said, I think I'm applying to Navy. And he was absolutely shocked. He just didn't see that coming, at all. And so started a process. You really have to start when you're in your junior year, not your senior year. And, went through that process you were alluding to for about a year, went and saw senators and congressmen and all that kind of stuff. And
so you have to get letters of recommendation from them.
They have to nominate you. Yeah. And they've got so many nominations. Your senator can nominate so many people, your congressman can nominate so many people, and so forth. And so you sit in front of these boards, and as a 17-year-old kid, they're like, they're so scary. I remember the kid before me brought in it looked like a 6-inch album of like his scrapbook of stuff. And I remember going there with nothing and thinking, because for him, so
getting
screwed
into the academy is everything.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he was prepared and ready, and I was not. And I just thought, man, I'm so screwed. I am not making it through this thing. But I did.
What made you decide to go there? Is there one thing that you can pinpoint, or
the opportunity? I mean, it was in front of me. It was given to me, and I really thought to myself, I got to take this. I don't understand it entirely. I actually didn't really understand everything I was getting myself into. I don't think anybody really does until you go. You can be prepared like that kid was prepared, I guess, but I think you don't really know until you're in it.
Well, and a 17-year-old, you're signing up for the next 10 years.
Yeah,
right?
You don't know what nine, that means.
But if you think about, all right, then you're senior, and then you've got 4 plus 5.
Right.
And so you're sort of setting the course for the next 10 years after that.
Right.
And I think about me as a 17-year-old and what I valued and how I saw the world. It's just different.
Yeah.
So what was the academy like for you? And you were talking about you love the team aspect of being on a team. And the way I would sort of capture what you're describing as far as what you loved about soccer, you almost love the strategic component and the buildup and seeing the pieces move and how they move together. Did you stay at center mid when you got to Navy? And what was your experience like playing soccer specifically at Navy?
Yeah, man, what a ride that was. So going to Navy, the first year, it's just bad for everybody. You know, that's part of the part of the gig is first year is called your plebe year, right? And you just, you're just getting molded and trained and all the stuff that comes along with that, you know, just the discipline of that and just the whole cultural sort of shock that that is.
I know at Army they call it embracing the suck, or at West Point.
Yeah.
Did they use any phrase like that? Or I know they also use embrace the suck there.
Yeah.
See, there's commonality between Army there and Navy.
Yeah, so I've heard that many times over my years. I actually, it's so funny you say that. I just saw that on a bumper sticker literally last week while taking my son to a wrestling match, and I just pointed it to him. I said, see that right there? That's what it's going to be like for you today. But I've heard that phrase 100 times.
What do you think of that phrase?
Another captain in the Marine Corps when I was in training one day said, when your life sucks, revel in it. Meaning, like, don't try to avoid those areas. You really do embrace them, because you will find a lot out about yourself in those moments. And I think there's tons of truth to that. I think I have definitely that idea has resonated with me many, many times. And I don't mind pain. I just want it to be short. I just want it, like, you know, I'll take it because I think it is important. I just don't want it to last very long. You just obviously want to get it over, get the lessons learned, and move on to the next thing.
There's a distinction between embracing and enjoying. They're not saying you're doing this and you're happy. Right. They're just saying embrace it because there's some value in it.
Absolutely. The point is, it sucks. It says it right there, right? You're not avoiding that part. You just have to accept it and embrace it and take it for what it is and then move on and be better for it. If you're not, it just sucked. And it's just, it's in vain, if you will. But I think there is something to be gained. And that goes back to my soccer career at Navy, I think, really helped teach me that in so many ways.
You're a big studier, mm-hmm. interested in leadership. Mm-hmm. What did you learn about leadership during your time at Navy?
Yeah, so a lot. I mean, that was, I think, the journey. Going back to sort of your question about my career at Navy. So I played center midfield there. You know, when I started, soccer by that point of my life, after sort of 2 years in high school, going into college, was the thing. I wanted to play soccer, and I was at Navy to play soccer in my mind. Certainly it was there for all the other things that Navy provided, but man, I really identified at that point in time as a soccer player. So I get on the team. I'm a freshman at Navy, and I don't get a uniform for the first 7 or 8 games. I mean, I'm the guy in the stands with the camera. My parents are in the stands, and I'm not that far away from them in a warm-up filming the game.
Is that typical for freshmen, or were you just at the bottom of the barrel of the freshmen?
Both. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's pretty competitive, right? You're playing against guys that are 20, 21 years old that have just been through the system. I think I had this false expectation I would be at least on the bench, on the team, playing and not feeling like I'm sort of outside of it. And I think it goes back to embracing the suck in a way. And so we weren't doing that well. What I just saw, though, going, you know, weaving in a couple of your questions here with the leadership, I saw the leaders of that team, guys I just looked up to, just grind, man. They just every day were just grinding and working. I mean, they would not accept anybody slacking off. And that was the culture at Navy, right? That's what it was built on. And so I almost wanted to step away from the team. I just, like, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. And it was actually my dad. He was just like, he said, you can't let the situation you're in squash the love you have for this game. And I almost let the situation dictate how I responded to it. And so I responded to that, and I'm just going to play. I mean, I'm literally just going to just pour myself into grinding in this game. And we had a week of practice when I was a freshman, and I was just an animal. I remember that week of practice, and I went from the stands to the starting lineup 7 days later.
Was that triggered by a conversation with Dad, or is that triggered by something else? Can you go back there?
I think a combination of the two. Really, really not liking the situation I was in and trying to find sort of how to deal with it as a young kid, like just trying to like understand.
So what were the options then? Can you go through that?
I think leaving the team was an option.
Staying at Navy, but leaving the team?
And that would have been tough. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it would have been really tough because I wanted to play college soccer at that point.
Transferring, right?
Possibly. Yeah.
So but if you could go back there, you're thinking like, okay, maybe I quit the team, stay at Navy, transfer, go play soccer somewhere else, or the decision that you made.
Absolutely. I would tell you that. Thinking back on it, that definitely probably crossed my mind with transferring somewhere else. Going, you know, back to Philly and playing at a place where I knew I could probably play.
Like your older brother.
Yeah, yeah, again, exactly. But I was really unhappy with the way things were going. And I looking back on it, I really think I was just being intimidated by these guys who I just saw were almost like larger than life sort of guys, leaders. And I probably was very intimidated by that environment, but realized I didn't have to be. I could play at that level if I applied myself to that level.
You said there's a week of practice, but I'm just trying to pinpoint, like what caused you to shift? Was it the conversation with Dad? Was it looking at other school? Like,
no, it wasn't the looking at other schools. I think that was sort of like the background thing. I absolutely would say it was the conversation with Dad. If you had to pinpoint a moment, that would have been it. And it was just like, you're responding to your circumstances and you're not applying yourself to this thing that you want to take on. And I said, I'm done with this. I'm done sort of being timid about this, and I'm done being in the stance. And,
beautiful. So a watershed moment for you, because if you decide to go a different path, you go down a different path and you might still be doing what you do now. Who knows?
Yeah.
But
I don't think so.
Interesting.
I think it changed. I think everything was a step to where I am today. And I don't think you could have skipped any of those steps and gotten to the same place.
Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting because watershed moments can show themselves formally, informally. And sometimes we don't even realize, like, I know a watershed moment for me came when I went to a Cheesecake Factory and had lunch one day, and I'm dead serious. Like,
I believe it, man. Like, they happen when you least expect
it. Yeah. It was a lunch meeting that I had with someone that got me into, that opened me to this field that I'm in now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and we think of watershed moments as like the baby being born or like getting married or those are the beautiful moments, but like you said about your dad, almost like the watershed moment wasn't him necessarily passing. It was this moment.
This moment, yeah.
Right? Like, and I think we make the mistake of thinking that it's this like outcome or this like, it's when we expect it. It's not when we expect it.
Yeah.
The old saying, like, man plans and God laughs.
Yeah.
It's like, no, this moment right here where you're sitting there videoing, it leads to you having a conversation. And I love what you said, which is basically that I decided I'm not going to work from the outside in. I'm going to work from the inside out.
Right.
And once I'm working from the inside out, now my environment, like I love thinking of it as a circle and you're the dot in the middle.
Yeah.
And you can either be the dot in the middle and work out or you can let the circle work into the dot. And I find so many humans, including myself, we have a tendency to let that outside circle just drive what the inside circle is doing. And if we can shift that paradigm, it's really, really powerful.
So true, man. And I think you have to just be willing to be introspective and just try to understand sort of where you are and what you have to respond with.
It's so much more natural to go the other way. It's so much more natural to think about our environment or our situation and I don't want to say blame or make excuses, but that's where my mind is right now. But it's thinking about those as the factors. And by the way, those do impact you. Like,
yeah,
it does have an impact on you. However, it's not in your control. So what can you do as that circle? And what you did for that week was play with fire and play with passion and play with fearlessness.
Fearlessness. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Without consequence.
And you know, there's this internal thing going on. And then if people are lucky enough or fortunate enough to have those mentors or those people who are willing to speak into you a bit as well, I think that combination is pretty powerful, right? And that's, I'm a huge advocate of coaches and leadership and mentors. And that's what I needed at that point in time. To, the fire was there. And I think, you know, my father and my mother both were good at sort of just giving that word of encouragement or challenge to see it come to the surface a bit. And yeah, to the point, it literally probably set the course of my life to today, because even today I've made so many decisions based on soccer and sport and team going back to that time. And that kept me at Navy. I mean, I honestly wasn't the greatest for the first year or two. It was like the greatest academic experience for me, social experience, certainly not. But man, I love that team. I loved the players, the coach, the whole experience of it was just something I would never trade.
Awesome. So now you're playing as a freshman. Mm-hmm. Walk me through what it's like to work your way up and become a captain, because I know that that's a big deal.
Yeah. So it was just time and effort. I mean, I think at Navy, like we were talking about, it's the team is so shaped by grit. The team is so shaped by now it's different. I if you look at the guys playing now, they're probably just amazing, even better soccer players than we were back then.
Yeah, but they're still, like, I work with American University, who's in the Patriot League, the same conference, and they know when they're playing Navy.
Right. They know it's coming.
They know. Yeah. Like, it's, I hear it. Mm-hmm. They almost are, like, I'm not specifically talking about men's soccer or anything like that, but just I work with the department, and when I work with teams and they're about to play Navy, men, women, they know they're going to be physically fit and mentally tough, right? Like, and it's, and for the teams that are playing them, they look, they're still skilled, but they know their unfair advantage at Navy is going to be that they're going to be physically fit and mentally tough.
And I think that's what we did. We were good soccer players, but we didn't lose games for effort. You know, we lost to better soccer teams, but
what happens for you when you put on that jersey? Are you aware that, like, we're representing not just us? Because look, the other schools, the Patriot League, those are kids that come from pretty similar backgrounds. Most of those schools are academically strong. Mm-hmm. They're not in athletic departments that are these glamorous, glossy, it's not Big Ten, ACC, SEC, whatever.
Right.
But is there something that happens when you put on that uniform? And I'm also interested in uniforms as we get more into the military as well.
Yeah, there is actually. And that's something you learn there, right? So the upperclassmen have been journeying that. The guys who graduated who are now serving on the front lines in the Marine Corps and the Navy and beyond, they're the guys that they talk about, the guys that they learn from. Our coach, I mean, legend in college soccer, Dr. Greg Myers, awesome human being, tons of respect for him. He always approached it that way. And we're not even just playing soccer here. We're actually preparing guys for combat. And there was that mentality for sure. I was just having a conversation with a couple guys I played with last night, Tim being one of them. We had this conversation around, that's what the environment was all about. It was college soccer, yes, but it was so much more than that. And when we put that uniform on, there was an element of, like, we're going to battle together. I mean, that's how we felt every single game, every practice. We felt that way. I mean, there was just nobody was going to be let off the hook for having, you know, a bad day because they weren't feeling it. I mean, the guys around them were going to get them there.
There's something going on for me physically right now, like a little bit of chills, which is you guys are taking sport and actually using sport to prepare yourself for what's going to come next.
Yeah.
And the power that comes with that, like when we're doing strength and conditioning, when we're doing all these stuff, we're training our body, not just for soccer. We're getting ready for war, potentially, depending on how old you are and what generation you are.
Yeah, and that's the whole physical mission of the Naval Academy, and I'm sure West Point and Air Force have the same, but that's a huge element to the entire process, and they do that largely through Division I sports. I mean, I think Navy's in the top three schools in the entire country in Division I A sports. It's a huge part of the development process. And if you're not in Division I, you're definitely on a sports field somewhere playing intramural or something. It's mandatory, right? So it's just not seen as this college athletic experience. It's actually seen as a formidable element in the character and leadership development of the athlete in and of themselves.
So I'm curious, when you're in that environment, one of the questions I get from people all the time and coaches is competitiveness. Mm. Did you see guys who weren't competitive enough drop? Like what, like, and did they help mold the competitiveness through sport? Like, I'm just curious to get your thoughts on competitiveness.
Yeah. Well, the environment around the soccer team was unbelievably competitive. I mean, that was very, very true. I mean, guys wanted to get after it. And I remember being on a scrimmage field in practice that week that I'm referring to when I was a freshman and even beyond. Those were harder games than the actual games and playing against, you know, our teammates. There's a guy named Brent Boyle comes to mind, a good friend of Tim's and myself. Like, I just feel like I battled that guy. So he was a couple years ahead of me, but it just felt like I wanted to play as hard as that guy played and battled him. I don't know how many times. And it was just a matter of just outworking somebody as much as possible.
Do you think that's innate or do you think that can be brought out?
I think I think both. I think to the point where it was probably innate to me and then brought out even further while I was there. I definitely saw it go the other way too, where it was probably innate and got people to that level. But when the intensity came up, they weren't able to respond or didn't want to respond to it. And, you know, made different decisions. And I think it shaped their career in a different way.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Talk about being a captain.
Yeah.
What's it like to be a captain at a place like Navy on a soccer team?
Yeah. So, again, I'll go back to it. It's one of the most formidable, probably the first real leadership lessons I remember. I mean, it was in position of leadership, you know, as a kid and so forth, but it's, you know, being captain of the Navy soccer team is the one that started for me. Like, that's when leadership started. I was one of seven of my own classmates. So we were, you know, I was there from the first day up until a senior year, and I was chosen captain out of those seven. So, you know, that was interesting. But I always felt like I was one of my classmates, one of the seven guys. Like, we had been through it every year together, and we were very, very close. And then what I learned about that is they were still my classmates, but there was a cost to leadership at the same time. So I'll give you a quick story. So, and my coach was a big, big helper in sort of learning this lesson. We went to Germany to do preseason training my senior year. Over there for a month, we were in a drill going terribly wrong. Just nobody was trying. It was first thing in the morning, everybody's kind of worn out and weren't playing well. People were bickering, yelling at each other, things like that. And I'm the captain, I'm a part of this, and I just had enough. And the coach was standing on the sideline just watching this. I don't know if he'd remember this. I remember it like it was yesterday. And I'm sort of waiting for him just to lay into us. I'm just waiting for it because coach is a pretty intense dude, and we were not doing the things that he would have been okay with. And he wasn't. He just watched. And so I did. I just lost it. I just stopped the drill, pulled the guys aside. And first time I was like, this isn't good enough. Like, we're not doing it this way. We're going to reset. Because I knew all the guys I had learned from wouldn't have never tolerated what they were seeing in that moment as well. And so get back on track. Team responds. Everybody's kind of looking at me like, what happened to him? And coach pulled me aside and he said, you finally get it. You're not one of the guys anymore. You're just not one of those guys, and you can't just be part of that crowd. And he was waiting for me. It's unbelievable. He had the patience to wait and watch that. And I was like, man, there is a cost to leadership. There's an accountability that you have to have as a leader, and that's got to be okay. You have to be okay with it. If you want to be a leader, you have to be okay with that accountability. You're still a teammate. You're still a classmate. You're still all that stuff, but you have to be willing to set the example and then hold other people's to that standard if you want to lead. If you don't, that's okay. But if you want to, that's what it takes.
You know, it's fascinating, David. I'm a big Twitter guy, so I love Twitter. It's where I get a lot of knowledge and information. And last night, I'm looking at it, and literally within minutes of each other, one person posts, lead by example, lead by example, lead by example. That was their post. This other person posted, leading by example is not enough. If you're just leading by example, you're not a leader. And I was just like, man, like it's real. And these were both like really well-respected people on my Twitter feed. And I had thought about it last night when it came through, but I didn't think about it for our conversation.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on that?
I don't think it's enough. I think you have to lead by example. Absolutely. You can't. So that person's right. You have to lead by example. I think secondly, you have to be very comfortable at some point in time, and this comes with experience and growth, to then hold other people accountable to certain standards that just have to happen in order for the team to accomplish the mission the team has set out to accomplish.
And you know what's fascinating about that is, so I think it, the leading by example is the primary part. That's that's foundational.
Right.
But the secondary part is actually what you're talking about, which is realizing that you're not just there to fit in and you have to be okay with sticking out. And by the way, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're always going to have to get after your guys and chew them out.
Right.
That also might mean that after a guy lets a goal in and he's the goalie, that you're going to be the one putting your arm around him.
Yeah, exactly. And you have to be able to read that. And that comes with experience, right? That's why, you know, I feel like I'm on this constant leadership journey of learning, because it's always changing. And what you're talking about is individual people. And man, that's why leadership is so hard, because is there any other thing more complex than a person, right? So like you're always dealing with their feelings that day, what they're bringing to the table, their baggage, all of their experience to that moment, and then understanding how to actually either kick them in the butt or put your arm around them. It really does matter. And to the point, it might be a watershed moment for them. And so, you know, I think it's important to take leadership roles extremely seriously, because you are shaping people. You are, like I've been shaped and still being shaped, I'm helping to shape others. And in that moment, I think I helped shape the team.
Yeah, because your coach's decision to stay silent was a leadership decision.
Absolutely.
It was, so leadership can also be quote unquote inaction as long as it's intentional. Yeah. Like it's just being very strategic on the human side of things. And I loved what you said. Like, you don't lead. I'm looking at a building right now. Like, I don't lead that building.
Right.
It's about humans.
Humans.
And
so complicated, right?
It's really, humans are complex and react differently and see the world. That's what I love about my work, is I've learned that I just love the complexity of humans. And so it's not to say that I wouldn't enjoy a spreadsheet or, you know, I could probably do that work or sell a product. I could do that work, but what I found my thing is that I just am so fascinated by humans.
Yeah.
But leaders have to be fascinated by humans.
You have to be, and you have to be willing to get dirty, like with humans, like really get into stuff if you want to lead. And that's not always comfortable, but it's important, because like in that situation on the field, what I was experiencing in that moment was a lack of leadership. And what you get in a lack of leadership in a team environment is a mess. And it's important. And the coach knew that unless I stepped into that role, we were going to be a mess. And somebody had to step up. And that's what I had seen with the guys that I grew up under watching. They stepped up, and he needed me to take that next step. And it's really important that leaders are willing to kind of take that step.
So you graduated from the Naval Academy.
Yep.
What comes next for you?
So really funny, really kind of interesting story. I break my leg really badly my senior year at Navy playing soccer. So that was the end of my soccer career.
When in the season did that happen?
6 games into the season against Old Dominion. Yeah. 11 seconds into that game, just snapped tib fib. You know, pulled a Joe Theismann.
Well, Alex Smith.
Yeah, yesterday. Last night. Yeah. So surgery, that whole bit. So my service selection was in flux. What I was going to do in the Navy after that was definitely like, it's sort of just up in the air.
What did you want to do?
So I wanted to go into special operations. Special warfare was probably my primary role. I had looked at the Marine Corps. I wanted to be on a team and active again. That's what I wanted to do. So I was looking at those paths. I could
give us those different potential teams that you can go join for special ops for those that don't know.
Yeah. So, well, start with the Marine Corps. You can be, sort of an officer, a platoon officer, a company officer, and you're leading men and women in a combat environment, so forth and so on. Special warfare being SEAL team communities where you're leading teams, in those same types of environments, and special operations, being EOD, bomb squad, dive teams stuff where you'd be doing dismantling of arms and so forth and so on.
And what drew you to that?
The team. I mean, flat out, just being back. It was the closest thing to being on a soccer team that you could find to me in the military, was those environments.
So as you're entering the military life, the number one priority for you or value is I want to be part of a team.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. I want to be a part of a very highly focused group of people that wanted to do something.
And was it that I want to lead a team or was it that I want to be part of a team?
Both.
Okay.
I think both. I think by that time I liked leading. Yeah, I really did. I liked that, that place on the team.
Okay. Yeah. And so where did you end up? What did you end up having?
So break my leg and I have to go to flight school. Well, not have to, I couldn't get into these other communities. So
because physically you're not going
to
be.
Yeah, I had a rod from my knee to my ankle. And so that was going to be in there for 14 months.
How did you handle that?
Badly. Really. So interesting. It was tough physically just because soccer was gone. That was a huge hole for me, just that I couldn't fill.
The identity piece.
Yeah, man, that was huge. And then not being on the team with the on the field with the guys. That
were you
was
able just, to lead them at all?
So that was a super interesting question. Yeah, I was. I mean, I felt like that's where I actually learned to lead from not being on the field. Like everything from up until that point was on the field, but I still could put my arm around guys on the sideline or give some instruction in a way that I never did.
But much, much harder because you don't have that example that they can see and feel and touch and,
that's
and
right.
be. But I've seen people be out for the year and then you actually see their leadership increase when they get to the sideline because they have to be very strategic and they then know that the only value that they can add is that.
Yeah.
And so it becomes clearer. But it's a challenging situation.
Very challenging. You have to sort of get your head around it and be okay with it. It's hard though. You want to be out there. I mean, I watch athletes, pro athletes, you're in the environments, you see these guys go down and it's tough just mentally to
you struggle with any depression during that time and any of that sort of stuff?
Probably. Yeah. Looking back, probably I was pretty down. Yeah. I was, that was really, really difficult. Just physically, just, man, it was tons of pain, tons of discomfort, very hard to get around.
Well, that's surgeries. The other part is, and you're not actually getting to work out and you're
doing nothing.
Soccer, I always laugh. There's never fat soccer players. Like you can't get away with, you have to run around.
Yeah, that's what you do, right? And that's all of a sudden gone. So I was laying in bed for about a month.
Yeah. Recovering. And so the combination for athletes that, literally what happens when you exercise and what it does for your mind is stripped. Identity wise, now you have to think about not being a soccer player. You also are having to think about other alternatives. I mean, there's some heavy stuff there for a 22-year-old kid or however old you are.
A lot, yeah. So I get through it. The interesting thing was I had a rod in my leg, no cast on the outside, so I was able to swim. So I just poured myself into swimming and I swam, every day almost probably for 300 days in a row. It seemed like I was just swam. That's all I could do to exercise. Interesting the way this worked out though. So I go to flight school a year later because it was the one area I was like, well, it's physical. I can be in a cockpit. It seems like it's really exciting and hard and I'm challenging. I guess I'll learn that, but I was lacking that team environment. Go to flight school first day and I failed the eye exam.
Wow.
Yeah, one letter on the eye exam. And they said, come back tomorrow, try again. Came back the next day, failed the eye exam again. One letter. They wouldn't tell me which one, of course. And I'm like, man, oh, man. So by that time, I had healed pretty well and was fit again. And they said, well, we got to figure something out. So I called the special operations guy and said, hey, I would really like to apply for your program. He said, I said, this is just what happened to me. And he said, all right, you got 30 days to try out and to do the physical test. Well, the cool thing about that whole story is without the year of swimming, I probably don't get into special operations. Anyway. Yeah. So I smoked the swim test.
Wow.
And I got into special ops and did that for almost 10 years.
And where were you? What division or where were you with special ops?
Yeah. So Mobile Unit 6 was out of Charleston at the time, but our operating area was Middle East and Africa. So spent time in Iraq, Africa, other countries around the Middle East doing special operations missions with a team.
And you know that I realize that we're running low on time, but just know that I would do a deep dive into that if we had some more time. And, you know, I always struggle to how to say this. Like, I think that's the line that people say is like, thank you for your service. Hmm. I don't always feel like when I say it, it's kind of like, oh, this is going to sound weird, but it's kind of like when someone passes, it's like, what do you say?
What do you say? Yeah.
Because what you want to say is something more powerful than what you actually comes out of your mouth.
Yeah.
And so whatever that is, that's what I'm saying.
I appreciate it.
And what did you learn over there? I mean, that's, you know, you can't just like, we can't just like fast forward the button, but I do want to get to what you're up to now, but like, give me like the bullet point versions of what that experience was like and lessons learned.
Intense, man. I mean, so again, you go back to sports. It's crazy how much sports has sort of just shaped me, but that Navy soccer experience led, and it's so true. You put that uniform on, you're preparing people for these environments later. It's exactly what it did. You know, we go into Iraq, I've got 8 guys on my team, and man, we're there at a very intense time, right at the beginning of the war. We're there to clear mines, you know, entering into an environment we don't really know, go in, and it's there's a mission and you're going to accomplish that mission one way or another and just go get it done. And, you know, it felt like that environment again, like everybody's ready. We're trained. We've worked hard, put the time in, and we got to go.
One of my frameworks that I talk about in every podcast is the mindset for preparation and the mindset for performance. I'm curious. So the example I give is we need to be humble in preparation, but a little bit arrogant when we're performing.
Yeah.
And you know, humility is a great skill to have. And I could actually feel your humility as you talk about your military experience. And when you're over there, you know, if you're humble, it could be life or death. And,
yeah.
And I think arrogance, people just look at it as a pejorative word and look at it as a negative. And the way I think of it is like, I'm an important person and I'm valuable and I matter. That's, you could parse out the definition however you want.
Yeah.
But I think it's one step up over confidence. And it's realizing that I know I matter and like I'm important.
Yeah. That's a super interesting, thing right there. That arrogance piece. I haven't thought about it that way, but I think our mindset at that point in time, I guess you could classify it as arrogance, which was there is no failure. You know, we're actually going to do this. And, that's the only outcome.
Failure's,
it's not an option. I mean, and so there's a saying around the bomb squad community, initial success or total failure. There is no gray area. And we lived with that. When we went to do these jobs. And so if guys failed, they just weren't going home. And that was just not an option. But we felt like we put the time in. We had done the training. I was fully equipped. I felt like the guys were fully equipped. We were going to execute the mission.
How often do you fail in the training, in the preparation part?
A lot.
So that to me is the dynamic, right? Yeah, like, a lot. Okay, we're going to be open to failure here.
Right.
And then you probably get to a point where now we're training. Like, so practice to me, so there's preparation, there's performance, and there's practice.
Yep.
Preparation is, okay, fail, go ahead, fail, learn, fail, fail. And then we're going to practice. And in practice, it's not an option because we need to have that pressure and that idea of like, what is it like? Mm-hmm. The intensity is the word you use.
Yeah.
And we need to practice that intensity, even though it's probably not going to be as intense as the real thing, but at least let's train that. And then perform. Is that similar to what you guys would do, or am I?
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, there's that preparation and practice was repetition with guys looking over your shoulder with trainers, instructors, just hammering you on the details, right? I mean, never missing details. Everything's a checklist. Everything's a, I mean, just such discipline in that practice and that preparation, because it's funny, you know, the interesting thing about even military training and practice and so forth, it's so disciplined, but it's so disciplined so that you can be successful in a very undisciplined environment, that you can stick to your principles when stuff's getting crazy. And that's what we saw. And that training and that discipline really paid off in the execution of the job.
So the training's perfectionist. You have to do it this way, perfect, so that you can be adaptable when you need to be.
Exactly.
When you're out there.
Exactly. And they're always throwing variables at you, but you have to stick to certain principles to be successful.
Were there any mental skills or tools that you would use to handle the intensity of literally dealing with, I mean, you know, one small step is...
I think it's discipline. I think it's practice. I think it's repetition. These are the skills that you're developing, is like just to be focused in very chaotic environments. But I think by that time, the guys that are still there after all that training, all that instruction, are the guys that could do it that way. I mean, so the guys that can't get to, or, you know, just don't want to be that focused in those environments aren't probably in those situations at that point in
time. Anything else from a temperament standpoint on what your team looked like and yeah, what kind of guys you were leading?
Just very proficient, very calm people in very intense environments. And if you can't be that, you're not going to be there, right? And
you get weeded out anyway.
You do. I mean, training is so hard. It's so long. It's years. Bomb school is 10 months. There's like 3 tests a week for 10 months. You fail one, you get a retest the next day, you fail that, you're gone. So every day is like the last day of your career. I mean, so, and it's supposed to be that intense all the time, because
it is.
You want to make sure when you get there, where we were, you can execute the job.
All right, we'll do a different podcast. Yeah, we'll go into bomb school, like 10 months of bomb school. We'll just do that. We'll call it the bomb school episode, right. I mean, I don't even know what to do with that other than I want to find out more.
Yeah.
But here's what I want to do next. So talk about what you do afterwards.
Yeah.
And I think that's fascinating. And mm-hmm. then I promise we'll get to water.
Yeah, so I go on to leave there and I go into corporate America, go back to Philadelphia, and I'm working with a startup tech company for almost 9 years. Great environment. Again, though, it goes back to team. I joined the company. It was like the fourth or fifth employee of the company because I saw a team. I saw people who wanted to figure it out and take something on. And so we were 5 people taking on Verizon. We were doing telecom services and so forth, but taking on the biggest companies in the world. It's audacious and even irrational to some extent, thinking back on it. But that's what we did, and it was just awesome to fight for it every day and go in there with a small group of people and being like, "Hey, we can win here," and going out and doing it. So I did that for about 9 years.
What makes a great teammate?
I talk about this a lot, even where I am now. I like interdependence. I know people, there's this like maybe debate between independence and interdependence and what's better and how does that work. I think people who are willing to do everything they possibly can for their other teammates, but also being willing to receive other people's best for themselves. I think that that is important, an aspect of the team. I think too many people think, I'm going to do everything I can. I don't need anything from you as a teammate. And I think that's flawed. I think we need to be willing to ask for help where we need help. And I think we need to be able to receive everybody else's best. And too many people don't give that up in a way.
You know, it's amazing. I think about my career, and for a long time I struggled with being coached or mentored because I wanted to do it myself. Yeah. And I wanted to, you know, feel that and think that that was fulfillment. And what I've learned is like, no, fulfillment is actually opening myself up, making myself vulnerable and getting better and allowing someone else to come in and impact me. And I think any relationships like that, a marriage is the same way. It's like, if you're just one-sided, that's good. That marriage is going to fail.
Yeah.
Like if you're not both making each other better, it's not going to work.
That's right.
And you can see it. And my wife and I talk about this all the time. Hopefully we're not the ones that people say this about us, but mm-hmm. you know, when we see marriages occur and we're like, yeah, they both make each other better.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That's good. I think a team's the same way. It's like, it's not one-sided.
Or it's not really a team. I mean, I guess it is by technical definition, but I think that's not what makes a great team.
So cool. Okay. Why leave corporate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It sounds like you had success at this tech company.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so what causes you to leave there and go into the...
Yeah. So quite frankly, I thought I was going into more corporate, and I'm on LinkedIn one night in my house, and I was looking at a job up in New York City, and I find this nonprofit, Wine to Water, looking for a CEO, and I read the job description, and it was 7 or 8 bullets of, you know, international field experience, which I had done a bunch in the Navy, and then about a handful more for organizational growth experience, which I had just done in a tech company. I was like, man, this thing's written for me. It was really one of those things that just sort of spoke to you. And for me in my faith journey, I think it hit me at exactly the right amount, right time, meaning like I had gained so much experience and I felt like it was a time that I needed to give back something. And I think when I shared it with my wife, she looked at it the same way. She's like, this is something like we just have to go do. There was all of this stuff that just lined up with my experience, but it was also an opportunity to be a part of something, in my opinion, truly beautiful. And that was, you know, providing people clean water, which is what we do today.
So talk about what that transition was like for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You weren't the CEO at a tech company.
I was.
You were. Mm-hmm. So you had worked your way up from, you said you were like the fifth person.
Yeah. So I came in as sort of the COO of that small company for what it was worth. I grew up there as the CEO. I became the CEO. And then it was actually acquired. And then I became the CEO again of the acquiring company. So it was such a really interesting corporate journey, if you will. Fascinating. Tough and very educational at the same time.
But what's it like transitioning from that position to going and work for a quote unquote nonprofit? I put quote unquote because we talked about that on the
On the phone. Yeah. So I felt like I've shared this with other people. I felt like I was on a speeding bullet train and all of a sudden I stepped off and the train just blew by me and I was, it was just gone. Right. And everything slowed down immensely and I had to relearn. I mean, I did not come into this job as a water expert. I didn't come in as a nonprofit expert. I came in with all the experience that I had and I had to figure out how it fit into this new environment. And so it was like I was starting over. I knew the leadership part. That's the stuff that I had and I was bringing to the table. But the context that I was stepping into, and at the time we moved. Like we pulled our family out of Jersey where we were very entrenched to join this group of small people, small team in Boone, the mountains of North Carolina. Huge cultural change for us, but I figured if we're going to do this, and my wife and I shared this opinion, we have to be all in, or we're going to be, one day looking for an exit because we're not all in.
And you mentioned a son earlier.
Yeah.
Like
3 kids.
How old are they?
So now they're 14, 12, and 8.
So you also are having them leave
their schools, their friends, their cousins. I mean, we were entrenched.
The culture that you had grown up with everything. As well. Like you said, I'm a team sport guy and part of that's Philadelphia for you.
I saw my kids growing up in exactly the same path that I grew up in.
So that's the hardest thing because I think most people will say, well, not most. I'll speak for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was like, how do I replicate my childhood? Because I turned out great. Like, right.
Right.
And like, oh, my brother's turned out great.
Yeah.
Like, let's just do that again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things people struggle with is either, or they go the opposite direction. My mm-hmm. childhood was awful mm-hmm. and I want the complete opposite for my kids. Mm-hmm. So I think you can play both cards, but here you are, like you've had a successful career up until this point.
Mm-hmm.
You have these siblings that you have a great relationship with. By all, accounts, you were raised the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you have that in you to say, we're going to move away from that?
I just felt like there was something more. I really did. My wife felt the same. We just felt like all that was a gift. All that was a blessing. man, we were so grateful for every day we had with family throughout that time. It's fascinating too, because, you know, we went home after the Navy, we're in that area, we're with my family through my dad's passing. That all sort of happened. We were all there, and it was just time to go. It was time for the next thing. And I loved that life that we had. I mean, I look back on it with great fondness and great gratitude, but it wasn't it. I tell my wife all the time, I live with a certain restlessness, and I feel like that's always been a part of, like, just always the next thing, always improving, always growing, and not being stagnant. And that was a big step for us to kind of take that next.
Is there any downside to that restlessness? Is there any part of that that you work on within yourself?
Yeah. I think there is, because I'm never quite satisfied.
You're a maximizer.
I am. That's one of my top five right there. Yeah. But I'm
top five. What do you mean?
Strength finders. Yeah. You nailed it. So I'm like an achiever maximizer in my top few, but I'm always reforming. I always want to just improve the process. I love the hard work. I love the grit. I think that goes back to like Navy soccer to now, is just always like, what's next? What can we be doing? What can I be learning now? And so to the downside to your question, yeah, because in some ways I wish I could celebrate the moments better than I probably do.
There's two things that come up for me. One, you can be a maximizer without being wise.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think you're very wise, and your decision to move shows there's wisdom, even though that might have had to do also with maximizing self.
Mm-hmm.
And the second, so they're not necessarily correlated. Like, you can have one without the other. And so I've been largely in the business of maximizing and unlocking people's potential. And I've tried to add this other aspect, which is unlocking possibilities, because I think life shouldn't just be about maximizing. There should also just be choosing different possibilities. And for you, while that was a maximizing deal, there was also a possibility that opened up for you, whether it was fulfillment for a cause, a higher cause, or going and giving your kids a different experience.
Right.
There's something very wise in there that I'm chewing on. And the second thing I was thinking about, and a downside to maximizing example, would be Urban Meyer, who coached at Utah and then left Utah and coached at Florida, won a championship at Florida, and literally said when he's on the podium getting the trophy of the national championship for college football, he's thinking about how unfair it is that he can't be out recruiting right now. And he doesn't remember the faces of his players during that time. And so Urban Meyer's been in the news recently, and I'm not going to get into that.
Yeah.
But when he got to Ohio State, he, and if you remember, he then flamed out. Literally had health issues. Yeah. His family said, you cannot do this anymore. He signs a contract with his family. When I go back to Ohio State, and says there, I want to be able to see the faces of our kids when we win the national championship. They win a national championship. And he says, I can tell you what their faces look like. So that's an example of when maximizing can go wrong, and how someone can create space and shift and still leverage their maximizing or their restlessness. Because football coaches, especially, I've been around them, like those dudes, they are nonstop maximizers. And I think part of the reason is because they have such control over outcome, as opposed to other sports. The head coach doesn't call every play. In soccer, like, your coach, he knew he needed you, because soccer, he can yell whatever he wants from that sideline, but it ain't affecting it the way that you can as a center mid. In football, those guys really do, like, draw up every play, strategy. They are so involved. So they have a culture of sleeping at the office. They have a cult.
Right.
It's what it is. It's probably not all that different than a tech startup trying to
we slept at the office sometimes.
Trying to get acquired. So I think the maximizing and wisdom thing is something that I'm really interested in, because I think you can have both. And I think you can have restlessness while also having rest. And it's just knowing when to leverage the restlessness that's inside of you that is so powerful and helped get you to where you are today, while also appreciating those moments.
Yeah. And that goes back to internal and external influencers, right? So I have that inside of me, and I have my wife, who is a great sort of barometer of that, and says, hey man, like, you're smoking us, all of us. Like, you're pulling us along, and I need to take a step back and be like, yeah. And I think leadership is knowing where you are with your team. And so making sure that I'm in a healthy place with the team and we're running at the same pace, or I'm just running at my own, and that's not good for anybody. Right? So we have to be in step together. And I have to make sure in my leadership, I am in step with the people I'm actually attempting to lead.
Were you around rowers? I mean, Philadelphia is a big rowing town.
Yeah.
Did you ever have friends in high school that rowed or anything like that?
Yeah, I did. And at Navy, a lot of rowers there. And I love the principles of rowing and how it applies to team.
Because it's exactly what you said. Like, you can have this stud rower and he might be able to go X fast and his other guys are going Y fast. It don't matter. And like, I've loved being around rowers because it's a sport I knew nothing about until I started working with collegiate rowers. And it is truly I think it's the biggest team sport because you literally have to slow yourself down.
To go faster. Yeah. And so they talk about swing, right, in rowing, and there's a huge concept. And I actually talk about this in the context of leadership and teamwork. I love that exact analogy. You know, if you're in perfect swing, your boat will go faster than all your guys actually pulling as hard as they can. It's phenomenal to think about it that way. And so looking for that swing is what we got to do.
But it's so different than like a lot of the principles you probably learn on a soccer field at Navy, which is like, let's just put our heads down and grind. You use the word grind. And so I find that word grind, I often challenge people with it. And you also use the word grit. So I like to make a distinction between grind and grit. Because to me, grind is I'm going to put my head down, just keep going without any sense of where the light is at the end of the tunnel. Whereas grit is passion and perseverance for long-term goals, or courage and resolve, strength of character. I break grit down into three different components. But I think grit is more of a path, whereas grind, and don't get me wrong, there's times when you're in a tech startup where grind is actually necessary. So I'm not even anti-grind. I'm just anti-grind for life. That's just not, I don't think that, like, I'm just going to grind my way through life. I think of it like sharpening a pencil. It's like, all right, you're going to grind. You're going to get that pencil in there. Yeah. But anyone who's like, who used to, I don't know if kids use pencils anymore, but you know, when you like would get it in there and you'd push it more and it just jam the whole pencil sharpener and then you'd have no pencil
sharpener. What's the point? Right.
Now you're done. All right. Let's talk about Wine to Water.
Yeah.
Give everyone an idea of what you guys are up to, what you're doing. One of the things that I know you're passionate about is just sharing the knowledge that you guys have as far as the sad state of water in the world.
Yeah, thanks. So, you know, joined Wine to Water about 4 years ago, a little more than that now, and learned that more than 2.1 billion people lack access to safely managed drinking water.
That's a crazy number.
Crazy number, right? Because there's 7-ish billion people in the world, but that's how many people lack access to water that's readily available to them that's safe to drink. Right. And so there's different stats and different levels of this, but that's essentially what the UN is putting out. For what it's worth, I guess it's right. But there's a lot of people out there that just can't go get a fresh glass of water. That's the moral of that story right there. And so, we at Wine to Water, we're committed to helping with that problem. And we think it's a problem that can be resolved in our lifetimes. And, we do every single thing possible, that we have, that we're able to help solve that for people. And so we've worked in over 30 countries around the world, done water for more than 750,000 people. And when we talk about water, it's not a bottle of water. We're trying to implement solutions that not only this generation, but the next generation of people will, receive benefit from. So, infrastructure, wells and water and filtration systems and sanitation and hygiene training in schools and all these things is what we do, soup to nuts. The technical term is WASH, water and sanitation hygiene. We do that full scope of water programs around the world. So we've got 3 international offices now, one in South America, one in Dominican Republic, and one in Nepal, looking to add more to that, because from those offices, we really feel like we can implement truly sustainable solutions for people.
Talk about the wine component, because I think that's the part that maybe people don't quite understand.
Yeah, so Wine to Water was founded by a guy named Doc Henley. He's an incredible human being, somebody who I've learned a ton about, just about humility and charity and selflessness and giving. He's a CNN hero. He founded the organization as a bartender in Raleigh, North Carolina, started running wine events. and raising money and providing clean water to people through it. And so today, you know, on our website, you can buy wine, and we sell wine and we provide wine and love the component of wine as it applies to our organization. We think about it in the context of gift and blessing. We have a lot of gifts and blessings that, you know, and that's essentially represented by wine, and we have the opportunity to turn that wine into water for people who need it. And so that's the one of the ways in which we raise money to go do our water projects.
It's just awesome stuff, and you know, I feel inspired by the work that you're doing. I had a random question. Flint, Michigan.
Yeah.
Like, you guys have any thoughts there or involvement there? It just seems like, you know, I think Americans, generally speaking, often are interested in solving the world, and we have a boldness and an audaciousness to us, whether we're a tech startup or wine to water, that we can go and make the world military, right? Like, we go and we serve the world. And sometimes I wonder, like, what if we applied all of that to our own country? And not in the same way that, I'll just speak from my, not in the same way that our president is saying it, but, but like Flint, Michigan's one of the things that I've been watching and just been like, what the heck?
Yeah. It's a disaster and it's sad. I mean, and it's incredible and unbelievable that it's happening to the extent that it is, and it just can't get resolved more quickly. Right. So, you know, one of the things, one of the reasons I am so passionate about the water crisis now and having learned so much about it is I do think we don't know how close this crisis is to us here. To the point, I mean, look at Flint, Michigan, look what's happening in California, look what's happening to the Native American nations of the Southwest United States. And so we're always probing and trying to figure out where we can be most helpful in those environments. We do do a lot of work in North America, specifically around hurricane disasters and natural disasters and relief and so forth and so on. So we do a lot of that kind of work as well. Flint specifically is such a complex issue because of the government, the states, the local, the federal, all the stuff that goes into that, the infrastructure that just needs to be rebuilt by the government, you would think. And it's a mess.
You think about what you just said, and it's just mind-boggling that you could go to all these other places all over the world and make this huge impact. And then like the idea of trying to do it with for our neighbors.
Yeah. I mean, and I mean, part of the reason is bureaucracy, right? Because we always work in collaboration, cooperation to the greatest extent possible with local municipalities around where I think that those public, private, even NGO partnerships are critically important to sustainability. Here, there's so much regulation and government involvement. I guess I would hope at the end of the day that would enable the right long-term solution, but the process to get there is just so difficult for whatever reason.
All right. So, I think that's where we'll call it a stop.
Yeah.
I want to thank you. There's so much I want to thank you for. So I tried earlier, but thank you for your service. Thank you for taking on this project and, you know, a massive, massive undertaking with an incredible mission. And looking forward to talking more today with you as well. And, thanks again to Tim for connecting us.
Absolutely.
And, if people want to learn more about Wine to Water, where can they do that? If people want to learn more about you, where can they do that?
Yeah. So I'm going to, for both questions, I would point you to winetowater.org. It's a place you can learn about all the work we do around the world. Amazing team. One of the things I didn't mention is this the unbelievable group of people I have a chance to work with there every single day. I tell them and they're the best team I've ever worked with because their hearts of service, man. It's just awesome. You know, maybe not the most skilled in all of our areas, but we have a team of people who are just unbelievably selfless. And that's just so inspiring to be a part of that. And, you can learn all about our projects, myself and our team at winetowater.org and, you know, buy some wine or, come check us out or just reach out to us. We'd love to have a conversation because, we do need people's help to kind of get out there and help folks, for clean water.
Awesome. I'm on Twitter at Brian Levinson, Instagram, intentional_performers. And you can go to our website, intentionalperformers.com. David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you for listening to Intentional Performers with Brian Levinson. Here is this week's episode gem.
I like interdependence. I know people, there's this like maybe debate between independence and interdependence and what's better and how does that work? I think people who are willing to do everything they possibly can for their other teammates, but also being willing to receive other people's best for themselves. I think that that is important, an aspect of the team. I think too many people think, I'm going to do everything I can. I don't need anything from you as a teammate. And I think that's flawed. I think we need to be willing to ask for help where we need help. And I think we need to be able to receive everybody else's best. And too many people don't give that up in a way.